You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, the United States administration announced yesterday that it's ending the protected status of Salvadorans in the country, giving them less than 2 years to leave or be deported. My guests today, Terry Stiassny and Jeffrey Howard, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including...
It is the insatiable dedication to uncovering the absolute truth that keeps us from turning a blind eye to corruption and to injustice.
Is Oprah Winfrey what the Democratic Party would need in the 2020 presidential election? Indeed, could any celebrity candidate be the antidote to Trump? Is it the right decision to let the rogue state of North Korea participate in next month's Winter Olympics? And what can we learn from evasive leaders? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome indeed to Midori House, and a warm welcome too to my guests today, Terry Stiassny and Jeffrey Howard. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. Let's start in the United States today, where about 200,000 Salvadoran immigrants are now worried about the possibility they're going to be forced to abandon their lives in the US and return to their homeland. The Trump administration announced yesterday it's not renewing the temporary protected status of Salvadorans in the US, giving them less than 2 years to leave the country or to be deported. Jeffrey, perhaps you can tell us a bit about the realities these migrants are facing, both in terms of this period of uncertainty and potentially what might await them should the US indeed follow through with this.
So these are people who've been in the U.S. often for a long time. Some of them have been in the U.S. for up to two decades. They came to the U.S. escaping war, escaping violence, escaping natural disaster back in their home El Salvador, say in response to an earthquake. And they're people who've been fully contributing members in most cases to American society. Nearly 90% of them are employed. We know that a lot of them have children in the United States who were born there and therefore are American citizens. And so really what this proposal to revoke the temporary protected status certification is a measure that will rip apart these families and will really send a lot of people's lives into ruin as they return to a country that is still extremely dangerous and that still faces a lot of challenges, the very challenges that has motivated Congress to recertify this TPS certification 11 times since 2001. And I think this recertification from Congress has given these migrants a legitimate expectation that they'd be able to stay. And so really what the U.S. government is doing is pulling the rug out from under them.
And Terry, you know, we on this program before, we almost get tied up in knots speculating about Donald Trump's motivations. But presumably, if this were an agenda that he understood or that he was interested in pursuing, he would have been able to shape this in a different direction. This is obviously driven by him. And we know that he has a very black and white view of migrants, of refugees and their needs, and how that fits into the American picture. It's another example, I guess, of how he's out of touch, not only with probably what the popular view in America would be, or one would like to think it would be, but with the history of America and what's made America the country that it is, socially at least.
Well, I think there's certainly a lot of potentially unintended consequences from this that Trump, I don't know how much he would have thought it through, let's say, but obviously, as Jeffrey just pointed out, there's the question of almost 200,000 US-born children who are US citizens. So Donald Trump may well want to send people he sees as immigrants home after a lot of, you know, after all, we've heard him talk about the lottery for green cards. We know he doesn't want people to settle permanently in the United States who don't currently have the permanent right to do so. The consequences that many NGOs in particular point out are obviously that he wants to send people back to... There may not be an earthquake now, but it is one of the most dangerous countries in the world. The murder rate in 2015 was 108 people per every 100,000 people. There's a huge risk of gang violence. There are thousands and thousands, almost as many as the numbers of people he wants to send back, of internally displaced people within El Salvador. So there would be a huge impact on the country of potentially of people coming back. You're sending people back to somewhere that is incredibly dangerous, which is not what most international law allows you to do. And also you're depriving that country of the huge amount of remittances. You know, as you've already said, these are people who are earning money, in most cases, you know, paying tax in the United States, bringing up their families there. A lot of them are sending money back home that helps the economy in the country, that helps keep El Salvador stable. And, you know, this is a country where the US has been involved in conflicts in the past. So the short-term goal may well be, yes, send people back, you know, get people out of the United States. The longer-term consequences we can't predict yet, because you're creating even more instability in a country that's already not stable.
And I wonder, Jeffrey, you know, to pick up on this idea about the Trump administration being out of step with its predecessors, was this one area where, to a degree at least, there were tacit understandings or tacit allowances made that, you know, what was designed to be temporary measures were sort of semi-permanent or permanent, and people bought into the idea that people who arrived under these umbrellas tended to buy into the old idea of the American dream and America as somewhere that was a safety net for them. Trump's, I guess, yeah, maybe following the letter of the law, but he's sort of exploding those old tacit understandings, I figure.
America's posture toward immigrants, particularly immigrants from Latin America, over the past several decades can only be described as two-faced. On the one hand, you have the American government saying, we don't permit undocumented immigration, come through the legal channels if you want to come here. On the other hand, countless American businesses are saying, come on in, we'll give you a job, you can get employment here. They're not really going to enforce the laws. They just have to say that. And so American society as a whole has implicitly and really explicitly sent the message that we are a country that is welcoming toward people who are able to get here, even if they are undocumented. And if you come here and you work here and you contribute to the economy, you're going to be reasonably safe from deportation. Now, I think that the adults who are living in the United States under the TPS certification from El Salvador don't have the same strength of a moral complaint against the government as, say, the DACA children who were brought to the United States while they were still children. But I think they still have a complaint. And especially since the conditions in El Salvador that justified the initial granting of the temporary protected status certification in the first place are still largely there, I think they can reasonably say, well, hang on, you gave me every reasonable expectation to believe that I'd be able to stay here and continue to contribute and continue to raise my family here. And now, seemingly just for craven, xenophobic, political calculation reasons, you're kicking us out and destroying our families in the process.
Terry, we talked before about the potential longer-term damage that Trump is doing and will continue to do, one imagines, on the sort of foreign policy platform, and about the perception of the US overseas and how that damage can be, if not irreversible, certainly it will take some time to eradicate. This is a kind of policy move which suggests to me that there could be a more insidious problem even on the domestic front. Does this begin to maybe irreversibly change that idea of America, the land of the free, this land of opportunity for those from outside? So much of its modern success is, of course, built on exactly that kind of migrant arrival. Can somebody like Trump and initiatives like this change that tradition and that heritage this quickly? I mean, is that a worry?
I think it is something that is very difficult to do. I mean, that is, you know, it's sort of built into the DNA of the United States, if you like. I mean, you know, Hamilton's just opened in London. You know, that's got the line that people say, immigrants, we get the job done. That's still, you know, a big idea that's there and it's hard to get rid of. I mean, it was obviously never an ideal system where you had temporary status that was sort of renewed every 18 months and people were never obviously quite sure about their status there. This is not, to me, the way to solve that. But when you hear Trump's rhetoric about, say, for instance, getting rid of the green card lottery, I mean, the terms in which he describes that, you know, most people, say, in Europe or in other parts of the world think, wow, that's great. You know, there'll be a lucky ticket to get the chance to get a green card to go to the States. And Trump sees that as a way for other countries to send America people that they don't want. You know, that's not how most of the rest of the world sees it. And I'm sure, you know, it's not for many people in the States. But though I guess, you know, there are his voters who may well completely agree with him and see immigrants coming in as, you know, undercutting jobs or whatever. But, you know, he's saying this for a reason, I would imagine. But yes, I think it could change those perceptions very, very drastically.
My worry about this is that there's so much noise generated by the Michael Wolff book about Trump, about his mental illness for office, is that the message about this just isn't getting out. And I could imagine a lot of Trump supporters, well, initially taken by the idea of, aha, here are these people freeloading off our society. Finally, we're going to send them back home. If they heard a bit more about it and they heard that a lot of these people have children who are American citizens, so they're either going to need to take their American children back to El Salvador, where they'll face a lot of danger, or they're going to need to break their family up. I think a lot of people, even a lot of Trump supporters, would come around to the idea that, hang on, is this really the right American approach on this issue? But I think the media story just isn't getting through because of so much noise generated by the Wolf book and generated by all the various news hand grenades that the White House sends every day and that Donald Trump sends out via his Twitter feed.
Well, let's stay in the U.S. and actually we'll come back to that idea about those news hand grenades. Oprah Winfrey's emotional speech on Sunday at the Golden Globe ceremony has seemingly thrown her into the conversation about 2020, the presidential race. It's been reported fairly widely that she would be actively considering another sort of terminology like that, running as a candidate. Terry, it's interesting, and I sort of posed the question in the introduction to the programme, does the Democratic Party, does anybody need a high-profile celebrity, someone who's known for their work on television, even if it's a lot more edifying than Donald Trump's? Is that what politics in the US and that political narrative, which Jeffrey was describing, is that what anyone needs right now?
I hope not, but I can see why people grasp at it. I can see if you suddenly say Oprah, she's standing there, she's got a ready-made audience, she has got a fantastic backstory, she is a completely self-made black woman who has become a billionaire, who's run her own business, who, you know, all off her own bat, you know, not relying on her parents. You know, she's revived the book industry with her book club. And she's got a lot of talent, she's got a lot of qualities. My big question would be, you know, why does everybody have to start with running for president? You know, can you not, you know, if Oprah said, right, tomorrow I'm going to run for my local school board and I'm going to sit on the board of governors of my school, or I'm going to run for mayor, or I'm going to run for, I don't know, you know, district attorney, run for something small first, see how it goes. You don't have to do President Oprah 2020, but that seems to be how it has to work now, because people sort of think, you know, oh, great, we've got a compelling story, we've got a great narrative here, we've got a brand recognition. And I just think perhaps what we need now is somebody who's worked and knows how things work and understand perhaps the finer points of the Constitution. Maybe that would be what we should be looking for.
You're such a stickler for detail.
I'm sorry, I'm boring. I know.
Jeffrey, what do you make of that? I mean, it seems, I guess, the counterpoint possibly to Terry's point there would be, well, hang on, we're talking 2020. We don't have time to find somebody out there. And the Democrats still seem to be struggling to find, certainly on a national stage, any likely voices who can really galvanise the party, galvanise the left or centre of the political ground. So they're kind of they're painting themselves into a corner where they have to go for a one-strike person. Could Oprah be it?
Hey, even Ivanka praised her after her speech at the Golden Globes. If Ivanka's on your side, boy, it's unmistakable listening to that speech that it was a political speech, that even the cadence, the repetition of certain phrases, their time is up, she was sounded like she was on the campaign stump. And I think Terry's absolutely right. She has a ready constituency. People would vote for her. I remember seeing Michael Moore, the provocative documentaire on TV shortly after the Trump election, and saying, why can't Democrats find better people to run? Why don't they run Oprah? Tell me Oprah would lose. Of course she wouldn't lose, he said. And there is something to this. Now, is she the ideal candidate if you could construct a candidate from thin air with exactly the qualities you'd like? No, she doesn't have the record of governance experience, but might, in the spirit of fighting fire with fire, be the right candidate for the moment. It's not a crazy idea. It's certainly not as crazy idea as it would have sounded a few years ago if you had suggested it. And so I think that it's a possibility. And so what I'm going to be looking for is she a student? Is she having briefings with people who are teaching her about international affairs, about the economy, about American constitutional law, about the politics of Congress? Granted, she already knows loads, I'm sure, about lots and lots of things, about economics, about business. But is she keen to learn more? And if she has that spirit where she's trying to learn more and more and get schooled up so she's ready for the job, I think she could potentially be a formidable adversary to Donald Trump.
And Terry, it's interesting because that narrative about the relative inexperience, people going for the biggest off, the highest office in the land. I mean, this was rolled out when Reagan was a candidate, sort of a whole political generation ago. And he had relatively quite a lot more experience. It was certainly brought up again when Barack Obama initially ran. He was painted at the time, it's hard to believe now, as a sort of relatively inexperienced candidate. We were talking before about social policy, perception of the US and that being changed forever. Are we arriving at a time where, again, for the highest office in the land, the landscape shifted and it is no longer going to be a safe pair of hands, a long-serving public official? It will just be the person that can win the narrative of the day.
Well, one of the things we haven't explicitly mentioned yet in our list of qualities or things you would like to have is money. And Oprah, she is a billionaire. You know, her net worth is estimated at being around $3 billion. And that is obviously one of the things that you need to run for president. So she wouldn't necessarily have to, you know, go around and ask people to fund her.
If she did need wealthy friends, one imagines she's fairly
well. She's pretty well connected as well. And obviously, you know, she's not a complete political novice. She has been out on the stump for Obama before, you know, in 2008. So, it's not something that she's completely coming to new. But I do still think that maybe that clout might be better, you know, be better served putting it behind, say, I don't know, a Cory Booker or a Kamala Harris or somebody who is out there getting that experience at state level. I mean, as you say, you know, Reagan had run California. He didn't come to it completely out of nowhere. So, you know, I would totally support her for governor of, I'm not sure where she lives, Worcestershire, but, you know, governor first, maybe then president, you know, work up to it.
Prove yourselves. Jeffrey, to that point, though, that the Democrats have been rather slow in identifying the next generation. Again, this is something we talked about. And there was a certain irony in that when we were probably broadly anticipating Hillary would win, I had conversations in this very studio about, wow, where's the GOP going to turn next? There's no likely candidates. Who's going to counterbalance? And yet, obviously, everything was turned on its head. And we're still having the same conversation, but about the Democrats. Now, a lot of people say, well, look, in terms of politics in the US, as long as you have people who are doing the grassroots work, if you like, on the state level, that's where it matters. And there are people hopefully coming through. But the movement, surely, and the political centre needs somebody, don't they? A single individual to galvanise them? Or is 2020 going to be simply too soon for anybody?
I think that's exactly right. And I think the case for Oprah is that she will be able to mobilise public opinion. She will be able to inspire a constituency of people to rally behind her in a way that none of the other potential candidates that we're looking at now seems particularly promising at being able to do. Now, maybe Kirsten Gillibrand will surprise us. Maybe Kamala Harris will surprise us. Maybe Cory Booker will surprise us. Maybe Bernie will come back or Joe Biden will come back, right? And you can just imagine them at the Democratic nomination.
A fresh face.
All of them on stage.
You maybe need to skip a generation.
Right. Oprah will be there on the debate stage. The Rock will be there. Bernie Sanders will be there. And it'll be this kind of crazy debate. But I guess I do have this worry. I mean, Oprah isn't interested in being on the school board, and she's not interested in the minutiae of being the governor of California or wherever she lives. She's interested in being she's flirting with the idea of potentially being the president. And I guess that just leads to the question, well, what does she want to do, right? What is the actual policy aim she has for the country, and does she have that understanding of policy? I bet she might, but I'd be interested in hearing more.
Well, Oprah, do get in touch with your early manifesto. You'll be more than welcome at Midori House. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, with Terry Stiassny and with Jeffrey Howard. Up next, is it wise to allow North Korea to participate in next month's Winter Olympics? Stay tuned.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, Terry Stiassny and Jeffrey Howard, my guests today. Now, North Korea is going to send athletes to next month's Winter Olympics in South Korea. This was announced as the two countries ended their first official talks for more than 2 years. North and South also agreed to hold military talks to diffuse broader tensions. Terry, perhaps I'll come to you first of all. Is this the right decision from Seoul, if indeed it was theirs to sort of decide to let North Korea participate and vice versa? At first glance, this looks like a positive story of a more conciliatory tone and something broadly positive coming from a peninsula where all we've been hearing about for several years really has been almost unbearable tension.
I would like to think so. I would like to think that there is still some remnant of the original kind of Olympic truce idea that you put these tensions aside at the time of Olympics and people come together through sport or whatever. So that's the optimistic, you know, Pollyanna-ish, it'll all be nice view. I mean, I suspect, unfortunately, there is probably a lot more to it. It is probably a lot more complicated. But that said, I think anything that starts to lower tension, any excuse to get people talking to one another is broadly to be welcomed. I mean, looking at this today, I noticed that one of the big issues of things that they might want to talk about is the issue of family reunions between families in the north and families of the south. These people have been separated for, you know, 70 years now, and it would be good if there could be some kind of advance on that. That said, I would imagine that, you know, even for the people taking part, the North Korean Olympic team, I would imagine would be, you know, not have a lot of freedom. They would be very worried about minding them and how they behave and where they go and what they do. And it will all be hugely stage managed. And then, of course, there's the question about how this is seen more broadly internationally and whether there is any kind of substantive progress or, you know, whether there's something going on in the background in North Korea, military tests, for instance, that we don't know about. And as we were sort of saying with Trump earlier, our eyes taken off them by the ceremony of North Korean cheerleaders joining in the opening ceremony.
Indeed. And Jeffrey, it's interesting. I was talking to John Everard, a regular contributor on this programme, a former UK ambassador to North Korea, of course. And he was saying that one of the problems is the North Koreans are quite good, actually, at striking, maybe surprisingly, a conciliatory tone, even outlining these moves they're going to make in the right direction. And then the sort of sucker punch, if you will, is, aha, well, to facilitate all of that, here's our demands. And presumably that will be the worry in Seoul, also in Washington, D.C. You know, what is the price? What's the small print that comes attached with this?
Absolutely. And the worry is that Seoul might acquiesce to the demands that Pyongyang issues, but Washington will disapprove of that. And so North Korea might use this as an opportunity to pit South Korea and Washington against each other, which, of course, have different interests. Washington is now centrally concerned with the prospect of a long-range nuclear missile that North Korea can send to the United States. Seoul has a more immediate concern with the many non-nuclear weapons that are currently pointed at it. And so any prospect for a thaw in relations, it looks like the South Koreans are going to pursue. I mean, so it's possible, of course, that that Kim Jong-un is going to use this as an opportunity to embarrass the South Koreans, to do something provocative. But it's also possible that this is genuinely a diplomatic breakthrough and that this is an ability for them to start having communications again, to have a conversation that increases stability on the peninsula, and that's good for the entire world. I don't see a downside to this. I mean, things are so bad that I see only potential upside.
Well, and it's interesting that the military hotline, which again has been dormant, I think, for several years, that was either has been or is being reinstated, which is also positive. That's a really interesting point, though, Jeffrey, that you make about the US, because I guess, Terry, we could pick up on this. Trump's been very clear. His rhetoric's been very aggressive about North Korean nuclear program and so on. Do you think that maybe, is it possible that Pyongyang has looked at Trump and said, look, we can't get a read on this guy? I mean, we all talk in the West about how tricky Kim Jong-un is to sort of preempt. Have they looked at Trump and said, we can't read this guy? We're not sure we can deal with them. Let's go back to Seoul. Better the devil you know. I mean, is that possible? Maybe that was the strategic play.
I don't. It's the theory. I mean, I've seen the theory put about that, you know, you'll remember better than me, the Madman theory that, you know, under Nixon, they thought, well, this guy is so unpredictable that we'd better kind of go along and open up. I think it's more probably the sort of accident of history theory, in that sometimes little changes, you know, the little pebble that sets off the avalanche, so something very small and seemingly kind of quite trivial, like an Olympic opening ceremony, can actually be the door that opens things up. They can be the thing that, if you look at, remember the Berlin Wall coming down, and it was just one official said, yeah, well, of course you can go through, you know, and there's some people sometimes don't realise what they're quite setting off. So maybe, you know, any small opening sometimes makes things change more than we realise. And obviously you want that to be controlled, you don't want things to be out of control, but as we're both agreeing really that, yeah, human contact, a bit of openness, you know, these things help, no matter how many missiles are all pointing at one another.
And that's a good point, Geoffrey, isn't it? And actually, again, we're not shy of putting the boot on this programme, but the Olympic movement broadly has had all sorts of problems, like a lot of global sporting associations. But one wonders if there's anything else which would make it as relatively easy to achieve such a volte-face as we've seen. You know, these were nations that were really sort of at the red line, and yet here they are, reinstating all of this dialogue, sending a team, they're going to march together in the opening ceremony, as Terry mentioned. Is sport the only thing that can do this? There aren't many other forums, are there, that can achieve that?
No, you'd hope there'd be a kind of music festival with different orchestras coming for. I mean, as I was reading up about this, apparently in 1991 they had a youth soccer and tabletop tennis global championship in South Korea, where South Koreans and North Korean youth played on the same team, right? And so these really are opportunities to put conflict to the side, and especially around children. I think there are some wonderful possibilities, and hear great stories about Israeli and Palestinian children playing in orchestras together. Not clear that that's helping to usher on the two-state solution, but I think there's immediate intrinsic value to these kinds of exercises, simply in anchoring us in some possibility of hope, in providing a protected space where there's some possibility for showing that we can live side by side peacefully as fellow human beings. And I think that's valuable.
That's a nice upbeat note. I like that. I like that. Let's finish today's programme with some more evasive politicians. Thai Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha showed a great deal of inventiveness when he escaped some tough questions at a news conference by leaving a cardboard cutout to do the job for him. This is actually true. He spoke to an audience outside Government House in Bangkok before the life-sized replica was brought out. Now, Terry, what I like about this person is that he has this thing ready. Who knows what it's going to be deployed to do?
Yes.
So we must applaud the invention. But presumably this is pregnant with all sorts of risks, i.e., well, the cardboard cutout could be a more compelling figure than him, etc., etc. What do you make of this? Commend him first of all?
My favourite part of this story is that there's not just one cardboard cutout. There are, in fact, about 17 of them, and they're all in different outfits. So some have, one has suit on, one has a tracksuit on, some have traditional Thai costumes on. So, yes, on the face of it, this is all very funny, and you can imagine, you know, Downing Street in the White House kind of calling in to the local print shop to get cardboard cutouts made as we speak to send to photo ops. I mean, obviously, there is, to put a bit of a down on it, there is a massive serious point here in that there is very little press and political freedom in Thailand at the moment. This is a prime minister who warned journalists in the past he had the power to execute them, and he's called a general election but won't allow political parties to campaign. So that's the not funny part of this, that, you know, by trying to make an amusing joke and having cardboard cutouts, he is obviously dodging any kind of, you know, questions from the media and freedom. But yeah, I can see that, you know, most politicians would probably like to do this and would like to, you know, you can imagine Theresa May having out cardboard cutouts with lots of different kinds of shoes on them. So, you know, it's a worrying tendency, but, you know, there is something a bit original and something you've got to sneakily admire about it.
Well, I do wonder, Geoffrey, what do you make? Are there politicians who are just crying out for a cardboard cutout? I wonder, I mean, if it was, say, I was confronted with the idea of, say, sitting down for dinner with President Donald Trump, for example, I would imagine that the cardboard cutout would be infinitely preferable as a dining companion.
Quite possible, quite possible. I mean, I hate to be the American on set who brings everything back to Trump, but I have to suggest that this atmosphere of hostility toward press freedom is only emboldened by the president when he talks about fake news, when he talks about CNN International being a bunch of liars, and then sometime afterwards someone invoking a CNN International report about Rohingya genocide as fake news or describing it as fake news. And I really feel like this is part of a global phenomenon of a loss of reverence for the press. Obviously, we see it in Thailand, where there's a complete paucity of press freedom. But we're seeing it even in Western democracies, an attitude toward the press that is, I think, extremely worrying. And I think part of it's fueled by the internet and the fact that it's hard to distinguish between the press that you can trust and the press that you can't, or at least a lot of people say it's hard to distinguish between the press that you can trust and the press that you can't. But it raises the question in my mind, and I don't know what you think about this, of how we can regain that kind of reverence for the press. And I don't think the answer is obvious.
Well, Terry, just very briefly, because time is short, you know, you're a seasoned woman of the press. Is that a global problem? And what should we do?
I have to say, I think there are politicians I have interviewed in the past, and I'm sure you have as well, where interviewing a cardboard cutout would have probably got you a better answer. Because that's the worst thing, is that people, they are so afraid of the media now, politicians. They don't want to engage. And they we want them to speak human, we say, but we seize on them as soon as they say something wrong. So you know, they give the cardboard cutout answer where they just repeat, you know, something again and again and again and never say anything interesting. So I don't know how we get that new relationship that's not just cardboard cutouts arguing.
And so, but could a bit of humanity buy back some of that lost trust that Jeffrey was talking about, in a word? Possibly.
Possibly. Yeah, let's
hope
so.
That's a partially upbeat note on which to finish the programme. My thanks both to Terry Stiassny and to Jeffrey Howard for joining us here on Midori House. Today, the programme was produced by Marco Sippi, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Leah Fournier. And our studio manager was Christy Evans. My thanks to them all. Music next, 1900. We'll have our design programme section D. And we'll have more on all the main stories of the day on the Monocle Daily, 2200 London time, right here on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.